Recorded almost live from an undisclosed semi-remote location under strict social distancing guidelines, it's time again for Chatter on Books. I'm your part-time announcer and random fill-in guest, Jamie McIntyre, and here is your full-time host and constant COVID companion, the effervescent Tori Clark.
That was excellent, Jamie. Thank you very, very much. Yes, welcome back, everybody, to Chatter on Books. So, Jamie, about 10 days ago, I did a focus group. I did a Zoom focus group on Chatter on Books. And the bad news is they don't love you as much as they love David.
Stop it, David.
I'm saying you. The bad news is they don't love you as much as they love David, but they like you a lot and they love your intros and your everything.
That sounds like some of my high school girlfriends.
Yeah, some of them were on.
They didn't love me as
that's
much.
Great.
As
some, that's great. I'm everybody's great. Friend again. Likeable. Terrific. That got me so far. Oh, you're so sweet. Oh, great.
Love you forever. Stay the same.
Wait, okay. Is this what happens in focus groups? They just like rank people?
Absolutely.
It's a junior high slam book?
Absolutely. I used to spend a lot of time doing a ton of research for many different reasons and thousands of different focus groups. The voice you're hearing, people, by the way, is Jennifer Weiner. Fabulous author. We'll be talking to her a lot about her book, Big Summer. But I have attended 1,000 focus groups, held 10,000 focus groups. And what's interesting is that it's almost like a jury. There's always one person who's the big talker, tries to take over, tries to tell everybody else what to think. Then there are some people who are shy and retiring with personalities. And that's what I kind of expected when I did the Zoom focus group. But we had about 20, 25 people who were fabulous. Those of you who couldn't get in, I really, really apologize. And they were very thoughtful and very constructive. And I thought, because we could all see each other, and I know some of the names because they're regulars, I thought they were going to be very kind and not say anything unkind about anyone. No. Well, we don't like this. We don't like that. They love David. There's like a whole man crush, girl crush thing going on with David. Just love him. Anything he does, they love David. Jamie, they love his intros. Somebody compared him to the poor man's Dick Cavett. So he's either the poor man's Bill Curtis, the poor man's Dick Cavett, which is pretty good, which is really good. And then Michael Kornheiser is also one of our buddies. They wish would embrace his professor from Gilligan's Island shtick. Remember the professor? Michael Kornheiser is very, very smart.
Yes.
But he doesn't really embrace it. And he doesn't
make a radio out of a rock.
Exactly.
If that professor was so darn smart, couldn't he have just made a satellite telephone and got over there?
You would have thought. But, out of a couple coconuts by this time. Yeah, exactly. So we've all figured out. We've got David Aldrich. We've got Jamie McIntyre. We've got Claude doing all the important stuff this evening. Jamie, it's nice to have you back. And I have a quick question for you about something quasi-important, but make it short because it's serious. So in the midst of all the other craziness that is going on and all the challenges that were going on, the resurgence of COVID-19, which is never going to go away. I think we'll be talking about COVID-20 and 21, God help us, the sequels. The story about the Russians offering bounties on U.S. soldiers, how important is it and what should we be thinking about it?
Well, it's very important because it shows, first of all, Russia's been meddling in Afghanistan for a long time. And trying to do the United States' will. I got two takeaways from this story. One is it was an important thing. And I think the part that's being missed is there's a perception that we got this intelligence. And because President Trump wasn't briefed on it and it was been downplayed from the White House, that we didn't do anything about it. But one of the reasons we know a lot more about it is because in Afghanistan, the military and the coalition were doing, they were acting on this intelligence. In fact, they almost got this guy who was the middleman who was doling out some of these bounties, but he managed to escape to, of all places, Russia. But they recovered large amounts of cash. They have a lot of evidence. And, you know this from your time at the Pentagon, intelligence is never 100%. And it's very susceptible to, if you want to act on the intelligence, you can deem it to be convincing and persuasive. And if you don't want to act on the intelligence, you can deem it to be not sufficient to take action. It can be the same intelligence. And so I think that's part of the debate we're having here. But I think the myth of it is that nothing was done because this intelligence went to the commanders, was shared with commanders in the field. They increased force protection for our forces. They pursued the Taliban who was behind it. And we notified our allies as well.
Right. I was going to say shared with the allies. Yeah. But in one of these places, they found $500,000, right?
Right. Yeah.
A ton of money. Okay. It reminded me of one thing because I could turn anything to a story about me. Back in the Pentagon days, Jack McQuethy, God rest his soul, from ABC, fabulous correspondent. Mm-hmm. comes in one day, my office, fall of 2001, early part of 2002, and said that some of his people over in Afghanistan had found out that U.S. military were offering local Afghan goat herders and whatever else $100 to provide information, intel on different things that were going on, and throwing $100 bills around. And the first thing you learn when you work at the Pentagon is you will always learn more from the reporters covering the Pentagon than from anyone else in the building or anyone else in the U.S. military. But by this time, you know, I'm a pro, and McQuethy tells me this. I said, that's ridiculous. I said, who's going to go around throwing around $100 bills to Afghan goat herders? Because what are they going to do with $100 bills? Ridiculous. And I toss him out of my office with great whatever. He wanders back in about 20 minutes, had contacted his people over there, and they had photographs of Afghan goat herders holding up $100 bills. $100 bills, which was a lot of money in those days if you were a goat herder. Okay. So, David, my friend, I was thinking about you this weekend because I was thinking, gosh, David.
America's friend, David.
Yeah.
America's sweetheart.
That's nice. Now, you need to change the little thing at the top of your Twitter stuff. So, no, yes, I was thinking 4th of July weekend, you should be spending time with your family and taking it easy. It was a big news weekend in the sports world, and a lot of it had to do with that Washington football team whose name I try not hard to use.
Yes.
So it sounds like Dan Snyder, owner of the Washington Redskins currently, is seriously considering a name change. It sounds like the Cleveland Indians are seriously considering a name change.
Yeah.
Will they change their names in the near future? And what's it mean for professional sports going forward?
I think it will be very hard for either of those teams to kind of walk back not changing their name at this point, right?
This is Dan Snyder, though.
It is. But, you know, when you have FedEx and Nike, you know, who are two of your major corporate sponsors, FedEx gave the team $200 million for the naming rights to their stadium. Nike is the official uniform company of the National Football League. And is saying they're not going to put this team's product on their website until they change the name.
Yeah.
That's a fairly big thing. Pepsi, which is the official, you know, soft drink of the team, has said you have to change the name. When you have that kind of corporate, what would the synergy, to use a word, a fancy word, all saying the same thing, I think it's going to be very difficult for Dan Snyder to say, yeah, I thought about it, I'm going to keep the name. Because you're just asking for people to walk away. And there's all kinds of rumors that Fred Smith, who's the founder of FedEx, said he wants to sell his share in the team. He's a minority owner in the team, and that he's just done. You know, he wants to get out, and other people do too. So it's part of why I was late. I'm trying to check out some of the stuff that we're hearing. So, you know, and the league has said, I mean, Roger Goodell came down from Mount Zion and said, you know, we agree, we support this idea. So, clearly, this has been in the works for a while. Once the league kind of says it's time for you to do something, it usually gets done.
This sounds like a classic case of what Churchill was supposedly to have said about the Americans, which is they always do the right thing after exhausting all other options.
That's right.
And it sounds like the Washington football team is ready to do the right thing after
that's exactly
exhausted
right. Yes, that's exactly right. And there's no, you know, you can't be, I mean, what it comes down to is the NFL did try, and it was obviously self-serving, but it does matter when the commissioner of the National Football League says Black Lives Matter. That matters. That's a big deal.
Yeah. And David, think about where we were. The first author we had on this show was Mark Leibovich of the New York Times, who had the fabulous story about the NFL. That was 18 months ago. And in those days, the NFL owners didn't ever have to really pay attention to much. They didn't have to pay that much attention to Colin Kaepernick. They just didn't have to. Think about how the world has changed. They now have to pay attention to these things.
Right.
ESPN just signed a deal with Colin Kaepernick, to do a documentary a series, these kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
I'm predicting if there are NFL games this fall, I'm predicting not all, but I think a lot of those professional football players at the playing of the national anthem will be taking a knee.
Yes. Yes. And I think that there will be no league sanction of them as there was a couple of years ago, I don't think. And so at this point, so if you've taken that step, you can't keep the name. I mean, you just can't. It's just not tenable to have this name sticking out there that no matter what the defenders of the name say, there's a substantial number of Native Americans and a substantial number of fans of the football team, black, white, all kinds, Latino, that find the name offensive.
Right.
So you got to change it, you know? So I think I don't think it's because Dan Snyder had an epiphany on his yacht one morning
No.
He said, you know, really, yeah. I've been thinking about this for a long time. I think he's been drag kicking and screaming to do the right thing.
Absolutely. Drag kicking and screaming. I heard he's been hanging out in Europe.
Yes.
What a guy. What a profile of courage.
And I'm not a superstitious person at all, but I do think this might be the only way to lift the curse of mediocrity that's been hanging over the team.
You know, they've been pretty bad for a while since he owned the team.
The fact that, okay, as ever, our featured author, Jen Weiner, with whom we'll be speaking in just a couple minutes, I promise, Jen, is listening to the show going, am I in the wrong show?
Exactly.
On the wrong show.
It's too late to cancel.
I'm fascinated by this because I am married to a man who works for Sports Illustrated. Ooh. And so I wind up sort of hearing more about sports than I ever would in my normal life. And I'm actually really interested in this and in watching it unfold. And I know today with NASCAR, Trump was tweeting about, you know, they got rid of the Confederate flag and their ratings are down. And NASCAR basically... Yeah. Like we stand by our decision,
and actually their ratings are up 46%. But who's counting?
Yeah, Trump also said CNN's ratings were down.
Right.
They had the highest viewership.
He lies.
They had in their entire history.
Right, right.
The thing that I saw, I mean, and I think the ratings prove it, is that no one's afraid of him anymore. Like, you know, it used to be like he would tweet and everybody would just like go into a tizzy and like, oh my God, and what's going to happen to us? And
that's a great point.
And we know that this like cultural divide is like a rich seam that he likes to go back to. Mm-hmm. And mine for distraction when things are bad for him.
Yeah.
It sort of looks like people are on to that, though. You know, like it's not working anymore.
It's certainly not working with the NFL, I don't think. Because, you know, again, the NFL, which clearly was intimidated by him 2 years ago and kowtowed and cowered when he went after Kaepernick, is not doing that this time. And is saying, you know, the players are perfectly allowed to do whatever they want. And again, the commissioner said the words Black Lives Matter, which he would not say for 2 years. And so that's just a sea change. Things are just different now than they were 2 years ago.
Yeah. And to Jen's point, Bubba Wallace, the NASCAR driver about whom all the conversation has centered the last couple of weeks, came right back with a very lovely, very profound statement saying, look, kids, boys and girls out there, you know, you'll be faced with challenges in life and you need to stand up. But I think you're right. The fear factor is not there, which is huge because that's what got Trump where he is because he played so well in the social media space. He scared people so badly in the social media space. Mm-hmm. So,
It's just amazing how these things that look like they're intractable and will never change.
Amazing.
I remember thinking this first back in 1989 when the Berlin Wall fell. Yeah. That wall looked like it was going nowhere a week or two before that. Then suddenly, boom, it's gone. We've seen that now time after time with, you know, everything from how the country's feelings about gay marriage changed, just like flipped overnight. We're in one of those moments now where we're seeing things that we thought were just intractable problems that were going to be talked about forever and nothing was going to happen, suddenly moving dramatically. Yeah. We're at an amazing point in our history.
Yeah, I think so too. And we're at an amazing point in Chatter and Books that we have someone as extraordinary as Jennifer Weiner joining with us. Again, we wouldn't have gotten you, Jennifer, let's be honest. We would not have gotten you pre-pandemic because we would have said you have to come down from Philadelphia, ride the Acela. Half the time it's broken. It would have been better than going to Politics and Prose because, as I said before, we have great drinks and snacks. But
I will tell you that the last event I did in the real world was at Politics and Prose with my friend Laura Zygmunt. She was on tour for her book Separation Anxiety. And I took the train down, not the Acela, because I don't like the Acela. I take the local train, which I find to be more reliable and basically as fast.
Yeah.
So I came from Philadelphia. We did our event. We had dinner beforehand. We had like this lovely meal and this lovely time. And then I went back to Philadelphia. And like 3 days later, they closed my kids' schools and we were off to the races. But, you know, I think of Washington fondly because it was the last place I went and the last, like, thing that I did before all this started.
We've started that game in our house. We've been largely quarantined with my husband and me, three of our grown kids, one girlfriend, three dogs, and we've largely lived together until recently for 3.5 months. And we started going, what was the last movie we saw in a movie theater? What was the last restaurant we went indoors and sat down and started thinking about those things? And they're not coming back.
Tori, I hate to interrupt, but we have a bulletin just into the Chatter on Books newsroom.
Go.
I've just been handed this. I'll just read it. I'm seeing this for the first time myself. It's from my wife, Roberta.
Yes.
Who says she loved The Next Best Thing.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Apparently she heard about our guests. Again, repeating that bulletin just in.
Outstanding.
Love it.
We'll update as we get more information.
Good.
Back to you, Tori.
And thank you, Jamie. And David, you're going to jump in if we get a name change for the Washington football team.
Right? I am. I'm sweeping Twitter. I don't think it'll be today, but it might be soon.
Might be soon. Okay. So we're going to talk to Jen Weiner about so many things. Top of the charts author many, many times over. New York Times number one bestseller many times over. At least 15 novels, 17 books, including some middle-aged books. Right, Jen?
Yep.
Which is your show in depth and breadth, which is remarkable. How has the band, your book is Big Summer. If we, it's not that anybody will see this because we're just audio, but we hold,
I know, but here it
I
is.
I can see it.
I hold the book up all the time if I like the book, and I love this one. How has the pandemic treated you as an author? You don't get to go to lovely, boring places like politics and prose, but.
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, like, I like being at home. I'm fine most of the time working alone in my office, which is in my closet, you know, just sort of where it's me and the screen and my brain. And what I didn't realize is like those 2 or 3 weeks where you're out promoting your book and meeting people, that kind of like, you know, it fills the bucket is how I heard another author talk about it. Like you get to actually like, you know, see people to whom your characters have meant something or, you know, a storyline really resonated with them or they found your book at a difficult time in their life and it helped them. And you hear all those things and you kind of carry them with you when you go back to write the next book. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, I've done a ton of virtual events. I've really had a good time, but I find that my bucket didn't get filled in quite the same way.
Let's talk about your life a little bit, Jen. You're quarantining with a couple of teenage girls, right?
I have a teen and a tween.
Oh,
God help me, right?
God help you is right. I'm the youngest of five girls. Deepest sympathies. Two is bad. Five is horrific, but two is really bad. Really bad. How has that been?
Well, I have to say, you know, in the normal course of their lives, they're a little bit like ships passing in the night, but because they've been sort of thrown together, I think that it's really like deepened their relationship in a really nice way.
Nice.
And I think they're going to have some pretty special memories of this time, you know, the way that I can remember like the giant blizzard in 1978 that like closed the schools for a week, you know.
Right.
They'll remember this, and I'm trying to focus on that, you know, and not the fact that they've, you know, almost killed each other a couple times, and then I've almost killed each one of them, and then the two of them together a couple of times. You know, I remind them and myself all the time, nobody's sick, nobody's lost a job, nobody's lost housing. You know, we have it better than an awful lot of people do.
Yeah, we say that all the time, too, on the show, but... And David and Claude both have much younger children than I do. Ours are 20-somethings, largely launched. Jamie's are launched. And again, we've quarantined with our three 20-somethings and the girlfriend of the three dogs. And we've loved it.
Yeah.
And whenever we started to get on each other's nerves, it's like, here, have another beer. Have another cocktail. Another. So we could do that. You can't do that with the tween and the teenager. That's a little harder.
Authorities tend to frown, I understand.
Yeah, tend to. So what were you reading at their ages? What were you reading when you were a tween? What were you reading when you were a teenager?
You know, probably a lot of stuff that I maybe shouldn't have been reading, I'm going to say. You know,
talk about your father's medical texts.
Well, that was when I was really little. Like,
yeah, go ahead. Explain.
That words meant things, you know.
Yeah.
My dad was a doctor. He was actually a child psychiatrist, which either explains a whole lot or explains nothing at all about me, but he had these medical textbooks that like smelled like formaldehyde because I think they'd been in rooms where he'd been dissecting things and there were pictures of naked people in them. So of course I devoured them, you know, that especially the chapters on naked people and all of the things that could go wrong with various glands and cause issues with the down there. So I know a lot If anyone has any questions, I can probably help.
That probably was not what it probably educated you, but didn't inspire you. What were you reading that inspired you and said, I want to be a writer? Because you went to college thinking I wanted to be a writer.
I can remember being in first grade and having my teacher like give me extra paper and let me stay in from recess so I could like sit there and write stories. I mean, I did not have many friends. I had this like, you know, I joke that it was sort of like a combination of like a giant vocabulary and no social skills that, you know, kind of made, kind of made things difficult for a long time. But I, you know, as soon as I realized that that was like a thing that you could do, that writers were actual living people and this was a job that you could have, it was the only thing I wanted to do.
Nice. Okay, so talk a little bit about, I want you to talk about going to Princeton and studying English literature, because you learned at the feet of people like Toni Morrison and John McPhee. John McPhee, I think, is fabulous. And he told you to go do what?
John McPhee told me to go be a newspaper reporter. So, I mean, he was probably, in terms of the class that had the most impact on my career path and my writing, probably it was his class. He taught one class at Princeton every other year in the spring, and it was called like the literature of fact. It was a nonfiction writing class. And he talked about structure, and he talked about details, and he talked about revision most of all. Huh. Like, you know, a writer is a rewriter. And he, you know, you turn in these pieces, you know, full of 21-year-old confidence, and you'd get them back like all marked up, and then you'd write them again. And you'd sit down with him, and you'd go through his notes, and okay, you know, this was good, this not so much, you know. And it was remarkable to get that kind of time and attention from somebody at his level and with his abilities. He was a wonderful, wonderful teacher.
Yeah.
So I graduated in 1991 and there was a recession. And like I said, I knew that I wanted to be a writer, but obviously, you know, you don't see in the classified ads, novelist wanted, you know, and we'll pay you to do this. And so I went to my parents, who at that point had been like spectacularly, horrifically divorced, like scorched earth, salt the ground, so nothing ever grows there again. And I went to each of them separately and I said, would you be interested in being a patron of the arts and supporting me for several years while I write a novel about your divorce and how it's messed me up? And they were both like, yeah, no, that's not going to happen. And so I'm like, okay, what are the jobs where you get paid to write? And, you know, it was obviously either advertising or journalism. And I picked journalism and I went and worked at a small daily newspaper in central Pennsylvania where I covered local news and I was the education reporter. One of my jobs was typing in the school lunches for five school districts every Monday morning, knocked the F. Scott Fitzgerald right out of me, I like to say. But it was humbling and it was good, you know, because...
Why was it good? What did you learn?
You know, I learned, I think, not to be too big for my britches. I learned that newspapers are a collaborative effort and not everything is glamorous or fun. You know, it's not always going to be all the president's men. Sometimes it's going to be typing, you know, chicken nuggets or hot dog in bun, you know, your choice of fruit cup or salad. You know, and I worked hard and I learned a ton. And then I sort of had like the, what was like a classic career trajectory, like small paper, medium-sized paper, large newspaper. I ended up at the Philadelphia Inquirer, which was a wonderful place to be in the 90s. And then I sold my first novel, you know, after like, I sold it like 9 years after I graduated. So I'd had those sort of hours under my belt of writing and rewriting and learning to take direction and learning to take edits and learning to look for details and think about language and pay attention to how people talked. So like all of that training, I think really helped me a lot when it was time to sit down and write fiction.
Yeah. Now we could talk about so many of your books, including Mrs. Everything, which is wonderful, loosely autobiographical, as I've heard you say. But let's talk about Big Summer. And by the way, I love it when we have authors on who have novels, because it's always just a title, and there's not this long, tortured subtitle.
It's not the big summer, colon, you know, exactly. Germs, guns, and epidemiology. Yeah, I know.
Exactly. I hate those subtitles.
I know.
Okay. So I want to read off a few things. Various things about reviews from Jen Weiner's book, Big Summer. The best way to get your fix of sunshine during lockdown. 25 books that make for a perfect summer read, top of the list. Your father's medical textbooks keep coming up. your father's medical textbooks keep coming up. Sexy, satisfying, Big Summer is the perfect quarantine read.
After I got that review, that was USA Today.
USA Today,
For several days, like every time I came into the like TV room where my kids were, I would yell sexy and satisfying, and they would both just be like,
Disgusting.
It was awesome.
Salon says we all deserve pleasure amidst our quarantine soap opera, blah, blah, blah. And wonderful, wonderful reviews of this book. I personally, because I can make anything about me, I'm a little offended. Great beach read, great summer read. Yeah, it's about this over-the-top wedding, friends, frenemies, all these kinds of things. Uh-huh. It's about social media, which is more relevant now than ever.
Yeah.
It is about what does friendship mean, what does truth mean. But give us the elevator pitch. Give us the elevator pitch, because if I don't, Jamie McIntyre will go, Tori forgot to ask what the book's about.
Yeah, what's the book about?
Okay, so I don't want your focus group ganging up on you.
Yeah, exactly.
So Big Summer is the story of a 28-year-old social media influencer who lives in New York City. Her name is Daphne. She's trying to put her life back together after she's had this like moment of humiliation go viral in the ways that things go viral these days. And she's doing okay. She's sort of finding her footing as a plus size fashion social media influencer. You know, she posts her outfit of the day and she talks about what she's doing and posts lots of pictures and has lots of fans. And back into her life comes her high school bestie, her BFF, Drew Kavanaugh, who is sort of an Ivanka Trump-esque figure. She's beautiful and privileged and rich beyond belief. And she's getting married to a reality TV star and wants Daphne to be in her wedding. And after some consideration, Daphne decides she's going to do it because she thinks, you know, I'll get a free trip to the Cape out of it. And I'll maybe meet some hot groomsmen and get some nice backdrops for my pictures of things I'm trying to sell people on Instagram. And things take a turn at the wedding. They take a dark turn and Daphne ends up...
Which was a surprise, without giving it away. That was a surprise.
That was a surprise, right? Yeah. And Daphne has to end up sort of investigating the truth about this friend's life and sort of the direction she's going to be taking in her own life, because she's at that moment in her 20s where like there's still a lot of choices to be made, a lot of thinking to be done. And so she's got to figure out the truth about Drew and the truth about herself.
Mm-hmm. It's wonderful. So it is a lot about social media.
Yes.
And using it. And it's used for good purposes. It's used for bad purposes in the story. Yes. How do you feel about it? As a writer, as an author, as a mom, as a woman in the 21st century, how do you feel about it?
I mean, I think about this all the time, that like, I can remember being an adult before the internet was completely the internet.
Yeah.
My daughters won't remember that. They will not recall a world where there wasn't Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat, TikTok, all that stuff, and where women didn't always lead these like double lives, where there was the nitty-gritty moment-to-moment unprettiness of what was really going on, and then the life that they were kind of perpetrating online, where everything is beautiful and everything is filtered and cleaned up, and there has been a lot of choice and intention behind what you're showing people. Mm-hmm. And I think there are wonderful things about social media. There's great things in terms of body positivity, for example, which is something that the book deals with a lot. Mm-hmm. The fact that you can see all kinds of different bodies, different body shapes, you know, women of all shapes and sizes sort of out there living their lives, being happy and fulfilled, which is something I did not get to see as a young woman. Mm-hmm. But there are trolls. There's dishonesty. There are people pretending to have lives that they don't really have. And it's hard to tell the difference between what's real and what's not. So I think it's a tool. I think it's a tool that you can use to build and to improve, and a tool that you can use to hurt and tear down.
Yeah.
Is this a book that your daughters would read, or will they read it anyway, even if it's not suitable for them? Or do they read your books?
That's a really good question. Okay, so the older one like claims to have read my books, but I'm not really sure because, you know, there's
six. Didn't give her the test, the pop quiz at the end.
I in my own head, I'm trying to pretend it hasn't happened and that she's a complete innocent and she doesn't know anything. But, you know, they'll probably dip into them at some point. Like, I haven't like locked them up at the house. Like, they're just out there. I mean, the rule in my house is that the kids can read anything. We pay a lot of attention to like what they see. Like, you know, they're not watching R-rated stuff. They're not playing super violent video games. Like, I think that there's a difference between information and content that you take in visually versus stuff that you read. And I think that stuff you read is more or less harmless. I mean, certainly I read a whole lot of stuff that was, you know, very sexually explicit and very violent sometimes. And I think I turned out okay. So one of the things we know
about social media is obviously that there's this false image of that people create, that curate their lives online. Mm-hmm. And that's not true. But is there a deeper message that you take away from sort of the influence of social influencers and that from your fictional account?
I just think it's interesting. I mean, the word that you use and the word that comes up a lot is curation. You know, the idea mm-hmm. that like you can be living a real life and that real life just becomes raw material for what you're going to pretend is the truth. And one of the things that interests me, like my kids study media literacy at school. Like that's just out there with, you know, math and science and reading. And oh, by the way, here's how to decide whether something is a reliable source if you see it online. I don't know if it's teaching them, though, to really like investigate the stuff that they're seeing on Instagram and Snapchat and TikTok, which is the platform that my younger daughter uses all the time. I think about it all the time. I think about like, you know, should I be stricter with them about what they're doing online? Should I lock it down? The deal is like any platform they're going to be on, they have to like friend me or let me see what they're doing. But of course my teenager has the Finsta, which is the fake Insta, you know, the friends only that mom doesn't know about or mom isn't supposed to know about. You know, I think this is a generation, like they're the first ones and they're figuring it out and they're finding their way and you know, how it's going to impact their lives, I think, has yet to be determined, really.
My favorite thing about why are the social media platforms called things like Facebook and Twitter and Instagram? Because narcissism is just too hard to spell. So I think it's great.
Well, I like that there's always a new one. It's like, you know, there was MySpace, which I had and probably still do because I don't think I ever turned it off. And then there's, you know, then there was Facebook, then there was Twitter, then there was Instagram, which I got dragged onto kicking and screaming. I was like, why do I have to do this? Like, I'm a writer. I do words. I don't do pictures,
but you do
have to be there.
Yeah. I'm sure it's an improper or just a cheap rationalization, but I rationalize the difference between personal and professional. So I advise clients and people in business and people at organizations, you have to use social media to advance whatever it is you're trying to advance, your cause, your,
yeah,
you know,
no, it's
your widget, whatever.
True. Yeah.
But then I want to separate the personal. And I think about it, boys, all due respect, it's hard being a girl growing up. And there are so many pressures. And the pressure of somebody saying something mean to you in the playground when I was a kid in fifth or sixth grade, well, that was a day. And it was two people. And I would get past that. With social media, it never goes away. And it can be hundreds, thousands of people. Seeing it and weighing it down. And so I think at a certain point, the quantitative becomes qualitative and it can change. And I mean, thinking about TikTok, the second suicide of a TikTok, a young TikTok celebrity, who got depressed because of something going on in her life and just said, I'm out. And I'm not saying that wouldn't have happened if they hadn't been on TikTok, but I love TikTok for the animal videos. My children are horrified that I'm on TikTok, but I am because the animal videos.
Some of the things that people do on TikTok, it's so smart and clever and creative. And I really admire it. But I will also tell you that like TikTok is the place where like my 12-year-old will come to me in tears because it's like all her friends are hanging out and she can see them hanging out in real time on her phone. And it's the cruelest thing. So, you know, I mean, it's just, I mean, that, and that's about some crap parenting choices opinion.
But, exactly. Okay, let's go back to Big Summer because it is a fabulous book and everyone should read it. Quarantine or no quarantine, everyone should read this book and read all of Jen Weiner's books. But it's very optimistic.
Yeah.
I think at the end of the day, you tell me if I'm wrong, but I think the takeaway is about real friendship. Mm-hmm. And again, without giving things away, Daphne really overlooked, went beyond mm-hmm. a lot of things to be a good friend. It is about that. And it's about being true to oneself. Is that right?
Yeah. That's
despite all these other things.
Yeah, despite all the other things, it's about being true to yourself. It's about, you know, realizing that everyone is looking at someone with envy. Everyone wishes they had something they don't. And what Daphne comes to realize is, you know, this body that she's struggled to accept and regards as this liability, you know, her friend who was thin and gorgeous is looking at the family life that Daphne has and thinking, I would do anything if my parents cared about me the way her parents care about her. You know, the grass is always going to be greener for somebody else. And the thing that you regard as your biggest shame and the thing that you hate most about yourself, like, isn't even registering really to somebody else. Yeah. I mean, it's all in the eye of the beholder, which was an interesting thing to think about throughout Big Summer.
I think I saw it on Twitter. Speaking of social media, somebody said, thank you, Jen Weiner, for writing this book. All of us have a little Daphne in us.
Yeah.
Or at some point, we all do. The boys, too. This is very much a boy book, too. Okay, let's get you out with this, Jen. How is the pandemic affecting your writing, or how will it affect it going forward? So I know you've got a third book in the trilogy of the Middle Age books coming out.
Right.
And you're working, or you're thinking about another novel. But how is if it is, and if it's not, say so. But is the pandemic shaping how you are writing things?
Well, the issue that I'm thinking about, because I'm a writer who sort of works in the here and now, you know, my books are set in the present. And it's the question I think that every sort of author of contemporary fiction is grappling with. It's like, do you write about the coronavirus or do you sort of create some kind of like alternate universe where this didn't happen? Because like, if you're going to be dealing with the present, you can't ignore it. Like you can't, it's just too big. You know, it's sort of like the same way, like you could have a book that happened where like Donald Trump wasn't elected or Donald Trump was elected, but you barely mention him. I mean, you can't because it's impacted everything.
Yeah.
And I honestly do not know what I'm going to do. I mean, I had this idea of like, I'm very interested in these pandemic accelerated courtships where people who had maybe dated a handful of time get thrown together because it's like, okay, I've got five roommates and you've got your own apartment. And I know we've only been on three dates, but we really got along. So I'm moving in, you know, I can see a novel. It's almost like an arranged marriage, right? Where you get these kind of thrown together by circumstances and they have to decide like what the relationship is going to look like, you know, if we ever come out of this, which we'll have to at some point in some way.
Right.
So I'm interested in that. But like, I was talking to another novelist and we were both kind of like, I haven't figured it out yet. Have you figured it out yet? No, I haven't figured it out yet either. But I, you know, and then the novelist Celeste Ng was talking on Twitter. She's like, I can't wait for 3 years from now when all of the men publish their pandemic novels that women couldn't write because we got stuck with all the childcare and the housework. You know, and then she was sort of like kidding, not kidding, but she's not kidding. Like, and
not kidding.
I mean, I think that there are novels that should be written right now that are not being written because every working woman writer has lost her childcare. You know, unless you've got like a mom or a grandmother or somebody or a husband who seriously has stepped up to the plate, like we're the ones, you know, we're still the ones working the second shift in many cases. So I don't know what it's going to, look like, but I think that, you know, personally, I could write a really fun pandemic romance. So look for that in a couple of years with all the boy books.
All right, this really is my last question for you. And we've had a lot of authors on, and we've talked to them about a lot of different things. They always talk about how hard writing is, and a lot of them are very angst-ridden, and very few of them ever express much joy, much happiness about writing. Mm-hmm. You seem to enjoy the whole process.
I love it.
You seem to like it. What do you like about it?
I feel like grateful every day that this is what I get to do for a living, that this is what I get paid for. I've always, you know, again, since I was like a little person, like lived in my head and loved reading, loved books, loved storytelling, loved making stuff up. And I, as much as I like writing, I like rewriting even better. And I think a lot of that was John McPhee's influence and Joyce Carol Oates' influence, like the idea that like once you have the scaffolding in place, you could go in and start decorating. And that was always the fun part. Like, I'm going to move this here. I'm going to put that there. I don't think I need that after all. Like, I mean, not every day is fantastic and wonderful, but most days I'm very, very happy to do what I do. And I feel very lucky to be able to do it.
Awesome. Well, we're very lucky to have you on the show, which is one good thing because of the pandemic. Thank you so much for joining us. It's Jen Weiner. Everyone should get all her books, but get Big Summer. It's really fun. It's very interesting. It's very timely. Very, very timely. So thanks so much for joining us, and stay well and stay healthy, okay?
Thank you. Thanks, guys.
See ya. Thanks.
Yep. Bye-bye.
All right, Jamie and David, do you have 60 seconds more?
Sure.
Okay. So we're going to try something here. And we talked about this on the focus group and they loved it. And this was something that we tried. We were going to do on video pre-pandemic and that's not going to work now. So I need my phone. Jen Weiner was terrific, by the way.
She's great.
She's good. She really does like what she does. I'm going to set my timer and I'm going to ask you these random questions because our listeners want to know more about you, David.
Ask away.
Yeah. So let's see. David, D comes before J. You're going to go first, okay?
Okay.
Okay, you ready?
Go.
I'm going to start the timer. We have 1 minute. We'll see what we can get done. Okay, what was your favorite childhood book, David Aldridge?
Oh, gosh. I just read sports books. So probably I Am Third, which was Gail Sayers' autobiography.
Oh, nice. Mm-hmm. Why was he third? I forget the meaning of the title.
The Lord is first, my friends are second, and I am third was
That's
his
right.
mantra. Yes.
Nice. Okay. If you were to write a fictional account of your life, what would it be called? It could be called that. It could be called ha 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 ha.
He's really more interesting than you think.
Awesome. It's very true. A minute's going really fast. Which of your favorite books should be a movie, but isn't so far?
Oh gosh. I don't know. That is a tough one. I don't know. They've all been made into books. I don't know.
Okay, we'll go on to the next one. We'll go to the next one. Scariest book you've ever read?
Probably Christine by Stephen King.
Good. Very good. Okay, that's it. 60 seconds. Right. Wow, that goes fast. Okay, Jamie, are you ready?
Yeah, I hope you're going to ask me the same questions.
No. Now I'm going to go backwards from my list.
I want his questions.
No.
I had answers to all those.
So I think we're going to, talking about this in the focus group was, the authors are always interesting and you go down these paths. Jen Weiner's terrific, but sometimes they'd like to know a little bit more about them, just kind of the basics. And so maybe at the ends of our segments with them, we can get them to do 60 seconds more. And someday, if we ever meet in person, we'll do it via video.
All right, I'm gonna try.
Okay, Jamie, are you ready?
I guess so.
On your mark, get set, go. Do you read hard copies of books or Kindle or audio the most?
Hard copies.
Okay. Do you have any guilty pleasure books on your bedstand at this time?
My guilty pleasure books were usually the Janet Ivanovich.
I love those.
Poem series. Those were, but I don't, they're not on my bedstand at the moment.
Okay. Well, you could get them back. Where do you like to read? What physical place do you like to read?
In bed.
Okay. Does it put you to sleep?
Yes.
Okay. Which of your favorite books should be a movie?
Last Train to Paradise, the story of Henry Flagler would make a great movie or miniseries.
Oh, I've heard you talk about this, or maybe we talked about this when we practiced on the video.
Yeah.
It probably will be. Okay. If you could invite three authors to a dinner party, and they can be dead or alive authors, who would you invite?
Because I was glad you said dead or alive, because all the ones I'd want are dead.
Time's up.
I understand inhibits conversation.
But go ahead.
But so,
because yes, with Maury. Question.
Okay, so I like humorous folks, so maybe Richard Armour, who wrote a lot of light verse and I read when I was a kid. Groucho Marx, I would
think. Oh, good one.
Maybe Russell Baker, because I really loved his autobiography.
Groucho Marx wouldn't come. Didn't Groucho Marx say, any country club that would have me, I don't want to be a member of?
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah. David, who would you invite to dinner?
I would invite Alex Haley, who had a nice 1-2 combo we like to call the autobiography of Malcolm X and Roots.
Yeah, so, just a nice.
For sure. Harper Lee, because everybody invites Harper Lee, right?
But then you have to invite, Truman Capote, because we know Harper Lee didn't write anything.
Ah, correct.
But that's
correct.
Okay. She can have a plus one.
I'm not a big Truman Capote fan, but I did read In Cold Blood, which is another terrifying book. Just an incredibly great book. So
here's the thing about inviting authors. I kind of feel like if they have something they want to say to me, they should just write it down. and I'm not sure that some of the people, the authors that we really, really love would be that great.
Interesting. Dinner. Yeah, it might not be. Yeah.
No, this is one of the good things about social media and the internet and everything else is if we had been doing this show, say 4 or 5 years ago, we would have been limited in our ability to figure out is a person a good guest or not. And Tony Kornheiser, when I talked about doing this show 2 years ago, he goes, just make sure they're good talkers. And 5 years ago, you wouldn't have known because you would just read and you'd read their books and think, oh my God, fabulous book. They must be great. Not. But now, anybody, anywhere, anyhow, you can find video and you can say, okay, they're fun, they're good talkers. And so we've had some people on. I keep talking about Mike Crowley, who was fabulous. Never would have had him on if I hadn't seen him doing some events, doing some interviews and say he was great.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks, guys. David, Jamie, thanks so much for joining. Claude.
Glad to be everybody's friend.
Okay, I have an outro here.
Everybody's okay, wait. I've got to do a little bit of housekeeping because I'm supposed to do this more often according to the focus group. If you're listening, thank you very, very much. We're supposed to thank people occasionally. Download us wherever you listen to podcasts. Clearly you are if you're listening to this. Review us on Apple iTunes and tell your friends about us because it's a great thing to listen to. And we come back next week with Margot Lee Shetterly. Pretty amazing. Been trying to get her for over a year now. The author of Hidden Figures, speaking of books with long subtitles, The American Dream and the Untold Story of the Black Women Who Helped Win the Space Race. And she is fantastic. I've seen lots of interviews with her. So come back in a week. And the world is ending here where I live with rain and thunderstorms. So everybody stay healthy. Go wash your hands. Love y'all. Bye.
Well, you've done it. You've made it to the end of another exciting edition of Chatter on Books. Any broadcast or rebroadcast or other description of this podcast without the express written consent of Tori Clark is highly encouraged. This podcast is available wherever fine audio programs are given away for free. See you next week.